The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it is April Fool's Day. Time to whip out the hand buzzer, plant a whoopee cushion on someone's seat, or play a trick on a coworker. That is, of course, if you don't work in a serious establishment, or so you'd think. Turns out that the White House, that fun-loving address, has a rich history of pranking and mischief. Joining me now to share some of the funnier moments coming out of the Oval Office is NHPR's Brady Carlson, host of All Things Considered and author of the upcoming book, Dead Presidents, An American Adventure. Hello, Brady, and happy April Fool's Day.
Happy April Fool's Day.
So when I think of early presidents, I can't help but imagine those, you know, stern, stoic-looking portraits. Very serious. Was that the case? Were there any early presidential pranksters?
They had a humorous side from time to time, but they tended to mask it as under alter egos. John Adams used to write these very funny letters to fellow politicians in Massachusetts under the pseudonym Humphrey Plowjogger. And he would write as, I'm just this poor, uneducated Massachusetts farmer, but it sure seems like to me we should have more freedom from those British people. So you'd get a lot of that. In the early days, officially anyway, presidents and other high-level prominent political figures tended to be the subject of pranks. In fact, John Adams' son, who also went on to be president, John Quincy Adams, there's a famous story where he liked to, for recreation, he liked to swim in the Potomac River. He'd take all of his clothes off and he'd just go swimming. And a woman named Anne Royal, who was, by some accounts, a journalist and other accounts, was seeking an audience for a change that she wanted to make in the government, found him at the Potomac River while he was swimming and sat on his clothes until he agreed to what she was demanding.
Well, that's holding hostage in the political sense. I guess so.
It worked.
That's a great prank. But some of these pranks were not deemed to be in the best taste.
Yeah, Andrew Jackson and taste are usually mutually exclusive, and so it's no surprise that his attempt at a prank early on in life didn't go so well. He was a young lawyer, and he was taking part in this dinner at a local tavern, and he started breaking everything inside. He was breaking all the plates, throwing the glasses on the floor. He broke the table. And then he lit everything on fire. You know, it's sort of the Andrew Jackson violence that we've come to expect from stories. There was another story where he was charged with putting a Christmas party together, very hoity-toity elegant, but Andrew Jackson, not exactly elegant. So he managed to bring all of the, shall we say, working ladies of the town and bring them into town, and everybody was scandalized and no one thought it was funny.
Oh, so it was supposed to be a swishy affair and instead it was
a different kind of
the working
of party.
Girls.
Yes. And so he wound up apologizing.
Oh, okay. Well, at least he apologized. Which presidents do you think pull off the greatest pranks? I mean, personal favorites.
My two favorites come from more modern times, actually. There's Lyndon Johnson.
Always a joker.
Oh, exactly. Love to tell stories. Love to tell jokes. Love to scare the heck out of his visitors at his giant ranch in Texas. He had a car that he liked to take people out on drives in these winding country roads in the Texas Hill Country. And after a while, he would drive around very quickly, and then he would start screaming that the brakes were out in the car and that they were going into the Pedernales River. What he wasn't telling them was that the car was actually buoyant. It had flotation mechanisms built into it, kind of a James Bond kind of car. And so he would scare these people just into the blue and then take them into the water and then start laughing his head off because he knew that they were perfectly fine. And then I don't know what they did. I don't suppose they found it was as funny as he did.
I know. I hope no one jumped out the window or jumped out the door and hurt themselves.
The other one I liked came from the Gerald Ford administration. They were having an event in Peoria, Illinois. They had a lot of reporters in the press corps, and they were at that point very close to the president and the presidential staffers. So they played a prank on one of the reporters who had been with Ford since he had been vice president in the Nixon administration. The press secretary got this reporter out of bed in the middle of the night saying he had this really hot news tip. So he went down to the hotel bar, talked with the press secretary, wasn't very impressed with this kind of non-essential tip that he had been given. But when he came back up to his hotel room, he realized what had happened. The Ford administration staffers had smuggled a bunch of reporters into the bathroom and a live sheep who then was, and I'll just quote from this reporter's book, the sheep was so terrified that she kept depositing remembrances of her visit on the carpet. The president wasn't there, but the next morning he had been involved in the prank. And the next morning when he saw the reporter, he said, I understand you had company last night. Here's the greatest part about this. The person who organized this prank was Gerald Ford's chief of staff, Dick Cheney.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, it all comes back around.
That's right, that notorious prankster.
Well, the White House also, in some cases, there are children living there, and children are always good with pranks. Any examples of mischievous pranks pulled off by the first children?
Well, if you want to talk about pranks by first children, you want to start with the Roosevelts. Theodore Roosevelt's children were an unruly bunch, to say the least. His oldest daughter, Alice, was known for placing bets on horse races in public. She would smoke in public, usually on the top of the White House roof. She carried lizards in and out of the executive mansion, and she kept a pistol, which she would sometimes fire off the back of a train. But the younger kids were pretty rambunctious as well. Some of the younger sons were part of something called the White House Gang, which involved not only Roosevelt's, but some of William Howard Taft's kids as well. And once they were having a sleepover at the White House, and Theodore Roosevelt had to chew out both sets of children for throwing spitballs on the portrait of Andrew Jackson.
Oh, that's just wrong. Well, some of these, so those are great pranks, right? But some, I guess, have crossed the line into dangerous, destructive, maybe even a little cruel. Tell us about the prank that Dwight David Eisenhower pulled early in his military career.
Well, when he was trying to get some of the men who were reporting under him, sort of light a fire under them, so to speak. And so he staged a fake Native American attack on their company. I think it was in Wyoming. One of them, actually, the goal, I guess, was to try and get one of the guards to fire in defense of this. And he did get one shot off before Eisenhower revealed, okay, this is all just an elaborate prank.
Oh, my goodness. That's, did he get in trouble?
Not that I know of, but, hopefully it hasn't been repeated. So maybe we've learned our lesson there.
Some would argue that pranks that some members of the Clinton administration played, apparently, this was on the incoming Bush administration, also crossed a line. What do they do?
There is a long tradition, apparently, of when one administration leaves and a new one comes in, that the outgoing people will leave certain messages or mementos of their time. And sometimes it's just a cute little tweak, like leaving the bumper stickers for the losing campaign in the desk drawers. The General Accounting Office found, as the Clinton people left and the George W. Bush people came in, that there was something like $15,000 of damage done. There were phone cords ripped out. There was people had glued desk drawers into the desks. There were swear words left on voicemail. They made a point of leaving that there were obscenities left on the voicemails. Very scandalous stuff in 2001. And there's the obligatory stealing of White House stuff, which is really nothing new.
Valuable stuff?
Not usually, but sometimes people will take, say, like towels out of the White House bathrooms. Or there's a funny story. Franklin Delano Roosevelt found this so funny that he used to give out blue matchbooks as souvenirs. And on the matchbooks in silver type, it said, stolen from the desk of Franklin D. Roosevelt.
It's April Fool's Day, and we're talking about some of the greatest pranks ever played in the White House. Brady Carlson is with us. He is host of All Things Considered here at NHPR and author of the upcoming book, Dead Presidents, An American Adventure. In recent years, the White House has played a few April Fool's Day pranks of its own. In 2013, the White House Twitter account, now this sent out this message that there was going to be a special video message from the president. What was it?
Well, it turned out to be a president, just not President Obama. It turned out to be that lovable internet character Kid President,
who
was wishing everybody a happy April Fool's Day. The White House, the Obama administration, of course, has been very big on trying to tap into the same spirit that we've seen in the tech sector. Google and Yahoo and all of the big tech and web players have made April Fool's Day a big celebration. So the White House has always been involved in that, too. In fact, last year, following up on the Kid President one, they were being the White House was being visited on April 1st by the famously scruffy White Sox and by the famously scruffy Boston Red Sox. And so they took that moment to announce the fictional President's Council on Beards.
Well, let's hear from Kid President because I just can't resist.
It looks like you're expecting somebody else, but April Fool's on all y'all. I'm Kid President, and I hope everyone has an awesome day. It's everybody's duty to give the world a reason to dance.
I'm into the White House. I'm here. Peace.
So is the White House getting funnier, Brady, or is this just a sort of political move, you know, appealing to the laugh? The funny bone of the masses is a little easier than their politics.
Well, I mean, it's a kind of outreach that that you do, and since we're moving into this era where your sort of snarkiness or your ability to laugh at yourself and the world around you is a part of your public profile, then yes, the White House has turned that corner as well. Although, I mean, in a lot of ways, that's really, as we've seen over the years, has been standard practice. I mean, Calvin Coolidge is not exactly known for being a real, you know, stand-up comedian.
He was the one who didn't talk,
even. He barely talked. But when he did, it was often very funny. There's the famous story about a woman who bet that he could get more than two words out of President Coolidge, and his response was, "You lose."
Ba-dum-bum. Is it ever inappropriate for a president to joke?
Well, there are always questions about the timing of jokes. We saw this with the George W. Bush administration, too. The Bush White House put out a number of very funny videos featuring their dog Barney sort of traipsing about the White House. And there were people who would complain that, you know, here we are in difficult times overseas, difficult times economically at home, and here the president of the United States is spending time filming his dog running around the White House. And you've seen that with the Obama administration, too. There have been people saying he spends too much time on web videos or slow jamming the news with Jimmy Fallon instead of taking on the problems of the day. But that's part of the difficulty of being president of the United States. You're trying to do a lot of different things, both ceremonially and officially. And there's only so much time in the day, so you've got to try and do a little bit of everything, I guess, right?
Brady Carlson there, and I am Humphrey Plowjobber. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Brady Carlson, he's host of All Things Considered here on NHPR and the author of the upcoming book, Dead Presidents, An American Adventure. And we have compiled a list of the greatest White House pranks. You'll find it on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up after the break, Wikipedia's longest-running hoax yet discovered. We'll hear about how a fake entry went for nearly 10 years before being found out. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. At one point, Wikipedia listed Plato as an ancient Hawaiian weatherman. Eric Carlson's Spot the Dog was said to have been written by Ernest Hemingway, and the first law of thermodynamics was that you do not talk about the law of thermodynamics. Wikipedia's open edit policy has made it open season for internet pranksters to create fictions presented as fact. The Wikipedia staff try to make sure these lies have a short shelf life. Not so in the case of a fake Aboriginal god named Jarido Wens. The entry for the fabricated deity was up for almost a decade before being taken down in March, earning it the dubious distinction of the longest-running Wikipedia hoax. Stephen Hutchin is editor and reporter for the Sydney Morning Herald and traced the origins of the Jarido Wens myth. Stephen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Good afternoon.
Well, we're really glad to have you with us. I want to make sure that there's no special Aboriginal pronunciation. Did I say Jarido Wens properly?
I think you can say it any way you want, but as you know, when you spell it out properly, it spells what looks like an Anglo-Saxon name.
Jared Owens is what it looks like.
Yeah,
so who is the great god seemingly named by, I don't know, George Lucas? What's the Wikipedia entry for Jarido Wens?
Oh, you know, I think the listing was a very short listing. It said something like, in Australian Aboriginal mythology, Jarido Wens is a god of earthly knowledge and physical might created by Altijara, to oversee that the people did not get too big-headed, and it was associated with victory and intelligence. So, you know, it sounds plausible, but it is obviously, once you know the get the joke, it's obviously a complete fabrication.
When did it go up?
It went up 9.5 years ago. I think it was May. forgive my maths. Was it 2005?
Mm-hmm.
On a Sunday afternoon, as it turns out. And I think in those days, there was less rigor around verification. Anyone could go into Wikipedia and fiddle with something. I remember there was a famous hoax around the great American journalist, John Siegenthal,
mm-hmm.
who passed away a couple of years ago. And it had him listed as one of the suspects in the Robert Kennedy assassination, which, you know, is very distressing for people who are obviously not involved in these things.
Right, pretty grave. Do we have any idea who made up Jarrito Wens?
No, again, it was masked. It was using an editor using an anonymous, I should say, Australian IP address. So it's still quite easy to mask exactly where you come from, but they can ping the country that it originated in.
The page did fly under the radar for almost a decade, as you said. It was even referenced in a book by an academic at California State. How was it discovered?
Well, I'm not exactly sure how it was discovered, but I know that it was written about by an actual Wikipedia editor in a website called Wikipediocracy,
mm-hmm.
Something I wasn't aware of before, but has been running for a few years. And it's actually a website for people who have a thing against Wikipedia to vent. So often there's discussions about hoaxes and accuracy and things like that. And from time to time, they write articles about things like this. There have been numerous other hoaxes over the years they've written about. But I thought it was interesting that the person who wrote that article was himself a Wikipedia editor.
Mm. Wikipedia has close to 5 million English language entries. Must be close to impossible to fact check everything. So do you know the process for verifying them?
It is a very, very complex system where stories with suspect details are flagged. There's a committee that goes through that. There's a process. This, in fact, was fast-tracked. So had it not been fast-tracked, it would have taken a number of weeks from the point of it being spotted to the point of deletion. But as I said, there is a process in place. But as you say, with 5 million articles, it is virtually impossible to make it clear of hoaxes. And that record, that dubious record that you mentioned of the longest running, is only for known hoaxes. There
right.
may be many others in there that have been around for as long as Wikipedia has been around, which is about 14 years.
But there have been 6 long-running hoaxes discovered just this year. Is there a big effort to expose them?
Apparently there is. So I spoke to a gentleman from California, Eric Barber, a former editor of Wikipedia and also a moderator on Wikipediocracy. Surprisingly, it was the first time he'd ever spoken to the press. He was very clear about his view of Wikipedia, that it is now staffed by what he called crazy people.
Hmm.
And I shouldn't say staffed, because that would be that it is run by crazy people. And for that, he meant both people who are on the official Wikipedia organization and the volunteers. This has been a long-running complaint about the Wikimedia Foundation and the conduct of Wikipedia. He says, and I've read this in other places before, that, you know, many experts in their field are being chased off Wikipedia by what he calls the crazies, or do these days.
What are some of the other notable or long-running acts of Wikipedia vandalism?
So there was the second longest running one, which was 9 years, 8.5 months, was what they call the Pikes on Cliff, which involves a fictional Spanish coastal house claimed as the 16th century home of a non-existent Irish sailor who survived a death sentence from Sir Francis Drake, the English explorer buccaneer. So you can see how granular that kind of hoax is, that you would have to be a real expert to pick that one out. There was another entry about a secret language used only by teenagers in the English county of Worcestershire, and that language is called Parfact. Again, a bit hard to pick. So you get the drift, right? They're not all big sort of ticket hoaxes. They're little bits of vandalism inserted in otherwise, maybe in some cases, and otherwise completely reasonable and factual listings, but that's why they're so hard to pick up.
I'm also wondering if the opportunity for pranking is a little part of the website's appeal. I mean, is there really any reasonable solution for a free encyclopedia edited by public moderators to do this differently?
Well, that's the whole argument. And look, I mean, you know, we all possibly, all of us use Wikipedia or have used Wikipedia to some degree over the years. It's the first thing that comes up generally when you search something because of the ranking that Google gives it in the algorithm, the search algorithm. I mean, I have kids of my own, and whenever I see them on Wikipedia, I say to them, you must be careful not to take it as verbatim. Wikipedia is great in linking you to sources where there's more likelihood of the fact being actual fact. I think Mr. Barber, when I spoke to him, pointed out in a survey by one of the web services that universities use to detect plagiarism, Wikipedia came up as the number one source of plagiarism over the years. That is obviously not the same as a hoax, but it just shows you to the extent to which it's being used.
Well, Stephen Hutchin, I want to thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Virginia.
Stephen Hutchin, reporter and editor for the Sydney Morning Herald, where he wrote the story about the longest-running Wikipedia hoax. You can find his article, Aussie's Jaredo Wens Prank Sets New Record as Wikipedia's Longest-Running Hoax. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up after a break, how to sell a hoax. We'll hear about P.T. Barnum's famous Fiji mermaid. That's after a break.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. April Fool's is all about deception. But before you can play a practical joke, you've got to catch the suspecting victim unawares. However, one of history's best hoaxes relied on keeping people suspicious. This story comes to us from Backstory with the American History Guys, Brian Ballow, Ed Ayers, and Peter Onuf.
When you go to a science museum, like the Smithsonian or the Museum of Natural History, there's this understanding that what you see is what you get. Displays are clearly labeled. If there's an animal on display, there's probably a little plaque explaining where that animal came from, what it eats, etc. Deception does not enter into the equation.
But for many museums, this dedication to the serious business of the truth can be problematic. How do you keep a crowd coming back if there isn't any intrigue? Historian Jay Cook told me that this was exactly the problem a place in Philadelphia called the Peale Museum faced in the 1840s.
And they're trying any number of things. They have dance concerts. They have magic shows. They even do a little bit of blackface minstrel shows as part of the mix, because these are popular trends, you know, new forms of show business that they're using, you know, to dabble in as a way to make money. But by the early 1840s, in the final years of the museum's existence, they decide that they will try their hand at presenting a mermaid. And a mermaid at this point is, you know, one of these wondrous creatures, you know, of myth and legend. And this is not the Little Mermaid by any means. This is something that looks like a kind of fossilized or petrified monkey corpse in a kind of scene of agony. You know, it does not look like a happy creature. And, you know, it's about 3 or 4 feet long. It doesn't look particularly believable to modern eyes, but it does look seamless. It's not easy to detect the fusion, you know, of monkey body and salmon tail. There had been mermaid sightings by whaling ships, you know, over the years. Mm-hmm. There had been stories in magazines and newspapers about the possibility of a mermaid's existence. But Peale's exhibitions are supposed to be as transparent and legible and knowable and categorically certain as they can possibly be. So what Peel does is to put a mermaid on display and say this was created by clever Japanese craftsmen.
So they're not even trying to fool you. They're saying, look at this wonderful thing that is nothing like what it pretends to be.
That's right. The fooling in the sense of straightforward deception or blatant fraud just doesn't make any sense within the Peel's conception of what an exhibition is, what natural history is, what the project of enlightenment is.
But they did make sense to somebody else in America in the 1840s, if I'm not mistaken. There's another mermaid swimming around northeastern United States?
There is, and that mermaid belongs to Phineas T. Barnum, P.T. Barnum, and Barnum develops this act early in 1842. He's a young man just trying to break into show business in New York City. So this is Barnum a good three or four decades before he gets into the business of traveling three-ring circuses. And it's really a fake mermaid, the so-called Fiji mermaid, that launches Barnum's career as a successful showman in American cultural history.
So I'm taking it that Barnum does not tell the world, hey, look at this wonderful example of Asian artistry. He is saying, hey, you think this might be a mermaid?
Right. And I think, you know, the thing that's so interesting about Barnum is that his entire mode of promotion, marketing, showmanship is about creating uncertainty, creating controversy about whether the object is in fact what it is represented to be. And so he does things that we, and certainly Peel, would understand as completely counterintuitive. He accuses himself of fraud. He hires rivals to accuse him of fraud, to exhibit rival mermaids who they admit are artificial curiosities and, you know, not authentic in any way, but then they accuse him of doing the same thing. And so Barnum's consumers don't really ask the kinds of questions that Peel would ask. They don't care much about what a mermaid eats, where it lives, its habitat, its life expectancy, how it mates. What Barnum's customers are interested in is the question of, is this mermaid in fact a act of imposture or overt deception or fraud?
I have to admit that I'm puzzling now about what mermaids do eat, because it seems faintly cannibalistic if they're eating fish. But you know, anyway, let's not focus on that. So, as you said, this seems counterintuitive that Barnum is actually accusing himself, although not in his own voice, of being fraudulent. Is any of this sort of like inoculating himself against real charges of being fraudulent? Or, I mean, is this just like reverse double psychology? Or, I mean, what's this logic about why this would work? And apparently it does, right?
It does. What Barnum really understands, I think, you know, in this intuitive way, is that his customers are now operating in a world of strangers, the new modern metropolis, where they don't know the people who try to sell them things or bring them into business ventures. This is a brave new world of the 1830s, 1840s, and many of the folks in his exhibition rooms are new migrants to New York City who had come from the rural hinterlands, you know, in New England and upstate New York. And they're working through these problems of perception, these problems of how you know what's real and what's fake, how you know who's honest and who's a criminal. And this is the era where the confidence man first emerges as a social type, right? A kind of named criminal category in American journalism in the 1840s. And what's so clever about Barnum is that he positions himself in relation to this as showman and invites his customers to weigh in on his own activities. And so he's allowing them to kind of talk through these questions and debate them. And then once the process is over, to conclude that they got their money's worth, right, in this entertaining exhibition where no one was hurt and no one was, you know, seriously cheated.
Jay, thanks so much for joining us and laying out that fascinating story.
It's my pleasure. It's great to be with you.
Look at this stuff. Isn't it neat? Wouldn't you think my...
And that was historian Jay Cook speaking with the American History Guys for Backstory.
coming up, a prank that clearly crosses the line to reprehensible. We'll talk about the dangerous trend of swatting when word of mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today is April Fool's Day, and while many will find themselves the victims or perpetrators of well-intentioned mischief, some practical jokes do cross the line into the realm of cruel or even dangerous pranks. Changing technology has played an essential role in the escalation of one particularly troublesome online trend called swatting. And joining us now to explain what that is and why it's such a problem is Catherine Cross, sociologist, video game critic and writer who has covered swatting. And Catherine, welcome to Word of Mouth.
It's very good to be here, Virginia. Thank you.
So before we do hear what swatting is, it might be helpful to describe an aspect of video game culture. A lot of people watch each other playing games online. So for people who are not part of the gaming scene, how does that work and what does it actually look like?
So this practice is called streaming, and it's a very popular way for video game fans to share the games that they're playing with one another and trade strategies and tips on how to play the game, and also for individual gamers to provide reviews of the content. And what it looks like is usually either it's a live stream of the game that the person is playing, or it's a split screen that shows both the content of the game being played and a feed of the player's webcam that shows the player themselves and the room that they're in and so on.
So they're witnessing each other either through split screen, single screen. How many people are involved in this kind of public online gameplay watching?
It is rapidly becoming one of the most popular social practices in the world of gaming. And numbers are, as ever, difficult to come by, but certainly some of the most popular streamers get hundreds of thousands of views on a regular basis every time they post. So it's becoming an increasingly popular way for gamers to interact with each other and share what they love.
So what is swatting and how is that connected to streaming?
So put very simply, swatting is the act of phoning in a prank emergency call to a police department with the intent of compelling the police to use a SWAT team in response. So for instance, you would call and say, so-and-so at such address is holding hostages, threatened to kill some people, please respond now. And, of course, the police, having to take this seriously, are very likely to send in a heavily armed response.
So one could be watching it happen real time. You know, you call in a SWAT team on this person's home and the police come in and sweep the place while they're playing. Is that the point?
Oh, yes. Yes, certainly the combination of swatting and streaming is one of the more insidious manifestations of the prank. It doesn't always happen while the target is streaming, but generally for the sake of, magnifying the comedic effect for the person that actually called in the SWAT, they want to see it happen live, right? They want to see the police officer storming into the room on camera in front of all of these people. That, for them, magnifies the humiliation aspect of the prank that they've just played.
Let's hear a video clip of this actually going on.
They're clearing rooms. What in the world? I think we're getting swatted.
Put your hands up! Put your hands up!
Get on the ground!
Get on the ground!
Get on
the ground!
Put your hands behind your back!
Wow, that is a really dramatic and extreme prank. Is it done for revenge? I mean, are you trying to get people in trouble if you swat them?
So there are a couple of primary reasons for this. One is that, unfortunately, there is just a deeply toxic subculture in the world of gaming where, yes, sometimes a gamer that has a problem with another gamer may resort to extreme measures like this to revenge themselves upon them. And the other reason is this hasn't been talked about yet, but the explosion of misogyny in the world of gaming over the last year.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the targets of swatting have been either women or outspoken feminist critics of any gender. The swattings that I wrote about earlier this year were entirely motivated by people that were seeking essentially political revenge against outspoken feminist critics online that they essentially wanted to punish or silence. And certainly even I was threatened with a swatting as well.
Wow.
Although thankfully that never came to pass. But really, yes, there are multiple motivations, none of them terribly good. This is the result of a toxic undercurrent in the community that believes that there are no consequences to their actions and that what they're doing isn't real, that it's just a game to them.
Wow. A number of celebrities have also been the victim of swatting, including very recently the rapper Lil Wayne. Armed officers responded to two prank calls saying that there was a shooter in his home in Miami. Afterwards, the police did release the audio in hopes of finding the swatter. So let's hear a clip from that.
Good afternoon, City March Police and Fire Jimenez. Can I help you?
I'm in Dwayne's house. I just shot four people, killing whoever else I see. I don't give a if you're a cop or not. I'm shooting to kill everyone and everything.
So you call on the phone just to say that? Hello?
It would seem, of course, that the police have to respond to every single call that they get like that. But can't they just trace them and then nab the people who made the calls?
Immediate tracing is not always possible. Sometimes the pranksters actually try to mask where the call is coming from. And some investigative work can ultimately reveal the original caller, but it takes time and is not something that can happen in the immediate term.
How often does this happen, Catherine? Is this, epidemic proportions or a rare occurrence?
It is growing in frequency. I've watched the gaming community professionally for about the last 4 years or so, and this has been a longstanding feature, but it has risen to prominence over the last year because it has become much more frequent and is a tool that's used for a growing variety of ugly purposes. In the world of gaming.
Any sense of the cost of swatting financially and, in the case of victims, the emotional toll?
The emotional toll can oftentimes be quite staggering. And financially, just if, for instance, you have been doxxed, which is to say your personal information has been posted online before a large audience, you don't know what anyone is going to do with that information. Generally speaking, dealing with that requires an investment of time and energy. You have to buy special software. You have to take time out to actually talk to the police, forewarn them that swatting may be in the offing, etc. And the emotional toll, simply knowing that there are people out there that want to harm you and your family, because let's be real, there's always a distinct possibility that one of these swattings could go wrong and that a police officer may discharge their weapon, somebody could get hurt or worse. And that's actually, in some cases, part of the intent. You know, you've heard of the term suicide by cop.
Right.
You could think of this as attempted murder by cop, essentially.
Right, especially someone like in the Lil Wayne case. I don't care if I kill cops. I mean, how jacked up are they going to be entering into a situation like that? Do we have any idea how much it's actually costing police departments to send out a SWAT team or what it does cost each time?
The figures that I've read that total up the cost of swatting, the numbers are in the millions because it's an expensive operation. There's a lot of manpower that goes into it. And it detracts public resources from actual emergencies.
Where do you think this is going, Catherine Cross? Police departments probably will increasingly become aware of it, figure out ways to screen it. But, you know, right now it seems to be kind of catching fire.
Yes, and that's the deeply troubling part for me. I feel that we are at a crossroads in the gaming community where, as a collective, we are all just beginning to grow up, so to speak. And a lot of us are horrified at what is being done in our name. And I do believe that in time, we'll start weeding out the especially toxic individuals who perpetrate this kind of behavior. But there's a deeper problem. One of the people who was arrested very recently perpetrating several swattings in the world of gaming of precisely the type that we began this broadcast with, was 13 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
And this is something that, as used to this as I am, as immersed in the world of gaming as I am, sent a chill through me. And it's something that says to me that we have a lot of work to do in terms of educating each other as citizens about the realities of the virtual world and the consequences of our actions on the internet, that we at this point severely lack normative ethics for dealing with one another online. And my nightmare is that one of these swattings will finally claim a life or permanently injure somebody at some point. As the frequency grows, and frankly, as we deal with an ever more militarized police force in this country, I do worry.
Catherine Cross, thank you so much for alerting us to this.
Thank you very much for having me.
Catherine Cross is a video game critic and sociologist, and there's a link to read her blog and to see some of her writings on swatting. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. The best kinds of pranks are funny and surprising, but ultimately harmless. That isn't always the case, as we just learned, but there is one form of trickery that can actually be good for your health. The placebo, once a necessary variable for testing the efficacy of medicines, is now being studied as a legitimate form of treatment. Ted Kapchuk is director of a Harvard-wide program in placebo studies and the therapeutic encounter at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. We spoke with him in 2013.
One of the questions is, do different rituals of healing or different rituals of medical intervention, do they have a different kind of placebo effect? And what we did in that experiment is take people with chronic arm pain, and we randomized them to either fake device. In fact, it was a fake acupuncture treatment that looked like acupuncture, but actually the needle went up the shaft instead of going into the body, versus a sugar pill. And we found that for reducing pain, fake needles were better. For helping insomnia, pills were better, meaning that the rituals of medicine, different rituals produce different healing or salubrious effects.
Rituals meaning that you get attention from a medical practitioner. Someone lays their hands on you.
What I mean here is that our fake needle and our fake pill obviously had no effect. Mm-hmm. They're inert. They have no effect on health or illness. But what surrounds the needle, what surrounds the fake pill is the activities of being in a healing encounter, like the doctor-patient relationship, like being in a healing environment, like the behaviors of waiting for the doctor, going into the office, hearing your story, being asked to undress, put back your clothes, then told something, they know what to do, and they give you something, and you do something. Those are what I call rituals.
Huh. Well, okay, so placebos are inert, as you said, no apparent active ingredients. So what have they been found effective to deal with, and what can they not do?
Sure. Well, it seems, and the evidence is still far from conclusive, but it seems that placebos are mainly able to change how a person experiences their illness. A placebo won't shrink a tumor, but will modify the amount of pain, discomfort, and fatigue a person has from a cancer. The placebo is about changing self-appraisal. How much does this make me feel uncomfortable or uneasy?
Mm-hmm.
While the placebo probably, as far as we can tell, and some of my experiments strongly suggest this, is that do not change the underlying biology of a disease.
Isn't there something, however, inherently obfuscating, I guess, about administering a placebo? I mean, what have you found about that? Does a practitioner tell a patient that they're going to be taking a placebo?
First, the bottom line, the prevailing ethics in our society, which I 100% agree with, is that no one should be given a placebo without being informed. Either in randomized controlled trials, you say you may get a real drug or a placebo, but in clinic, you should never deceive a patient. One of the reasons we study placebo effect is it's a way of showing the power of ritual, symbols, doctor-patient relationship without the confound of medication. But some of our research suggests that it may be possible to give people placebos, be honest and ethical and tell them they are placebos, and still get a beneficial effect. The word placebo is a bad word for good effect, and it has that bad connection there of deception.
And that is our previous conversation with Ted Kapchuk, associate professor at Harvard Medical School and director of the Harvard-wide program in placebo studies. There's a lot more to learn about Ted's work to better understand the placebo effect. You can find it at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's so much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety at the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the program, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tomorrow, April 2nd, we'll return to our regular serious, stuffy, and generally uptight format at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.